Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with long overdue changes in drug sentencing announced by Attorney General Holder, and speak with California Superior Court Judge James Gray, who was a former federal prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's Office and ran for Vice President of the United States in 2012 as a Libertarian Party's candidate. We'll discuss a federal prison system that has grown 800% since the 1980s and the moral and human cost to the United States, which has 5% of the world's population but holds 25% of the world's prisoners. Then we'll speak with the filmmaker of the Academy Award-nominated Best Documentary Feature of 2012, The House I Live In. Eugene Jarecki joins us to discuss the sentencing reforms which were called for in his powerful and wide-ranging examination of the prison industrial complex and our failed war on drugs in a film that takes viewers from ravaged inner-city communities to overcrowded prisons with drug users, prison guards, narcotics officers, and judges all acknowledging a broken system that might now begin to change direction. Then finally, we will speak with Michael Cohen, a columnist at Foreign Policy, who previously served in the State Department as chief speechwriter for the United States representative at the United Nations. We will discuss his recent article at the UK Guardian, Threat to America? The size of our own military budget, that examines our bloated military budget compared to what he sees as the paltry foreign policy threats outlined by the departing deputy head of the CIA as clear and present dangers. And joining us now is James Gray, the author of Why Our Drug Laws Have Failed and What We Can Do About It. He is a California Superior Court judge, a former federal prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Los Angeles, and in 2012 he ran for Vice President of the United States on the Libertarian Party ticket with Gary Johnson. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Gray.
Well, Ian, thank you. It's nice to be with you. And in your introductory comments, you used three very strong adjectives with which I agree with all of them: long overdue changes, failed war on drugs, and broken system. You're absolutely right in all three of those analyses.
Well, the Attorney General did say, just quoting him, we must face the reality that, as it stands, our system in too many ways is broken. And with an outsized, unnecessary large prison population, we need to ensure that incarceration is used to punish, to deter, and to rehabilitate, not merely to warehouse and to forget.
He's right. This is coming probably 25 years too late, but I'd rather have it today than tomorrow. We've got to start being smart on crime instead of tough on crime. Now, I know politically, of course, power in incarceration sells. It started with the Nixon administration, really, early 1970s, where they literally knew, Ian, that drug treatment works far better than incarceration, but they also saw enormous political advantages in going into incarceration instead. And don't take it from me, take it from Kleindienst, his attorney general at the time, and he said, we were absolutely overwhelmed at the beneficial response we got politically, even though they knew that it was harmful for our country and the people.
So was that a part of the kind of law and order hysteria? Was that the idea that it's easier to stir up people's paranoia than to appeal to their better senses?
Yes, that's the problem. You have people. I have had two sitting congressmen here in Orange County tell me when they were in office that, Jim, you don't understand. Most people in Washington realize the war on drugs is not winnable, but it's eminently fundable, and they're addicted to the drug war funding. So it's paranoia regarding politics, but it's also money. It's unbelievable the amount of money that people are making by pursuing this failed and hopeless policy of drug prohibition.
And do we have any accounting on how much we've spent since President Nixon began the war on drugs and started the Drug Enforcement Administration?
It depends, of course, how you do the accounting. It's easily $1 trillion. And have we gotten our money's worth? The answer categorically is no. There's more drugs today available than ever before. The prices are lower. Anybody that wants to get them can. It's easier for our children to get methamphetamines, marijuana, or whatever, if they want to, than it is a six-pack of beer. And even worse than that, because Governor Johnson said this well in the campaign, that about 90% of all of the drug problems are drug prohibition problems, the drug money. Yes, there are drug problems too, and we're not minimizing them, but what you do is you treat marijuana like alcohol, for example, hold people accountable for what they do, like we do with alcohol and anything else, and then regulate and control these drugs. You do away with the quality control problems. You stop luring children into youth gangs to sell drugs and the rest, and start really making some progress. And, of course, marijuana is the largest cash crop today in the state of California. Number two is grapes, by the way. So let's take that crop anyway, make sure that we regulate, control it, no advertising, but tax it and use that money instead of going to juvenile street gangs and Mexican drug cartels and Hell's Angels and other thugs. Use it to pay our firefighters, pay our teachers, and fix our highways. It's not a hard decision to make, and we are in the process now of making it, led by the states recently of Colorado and Washington. This war on drugs, certainly war on marijuana, is close to over because it's so transparent that it's failed.
And again, I'm speaking with James Gray, who's the author of Why Our Drug Laws Have Failed and What We Can Do About It. He is a California Superior Court judge and former federal prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Los Angeles. And in 2012, he ran for vice president of the United States on the Libertarian Party ticket with Gary Johnson. So given that back when the war on drugs started, the Nixon administration knew that treatment was better than incarceration, but then decided incarceration was politically more popular. What do you take from what the Attorney General said today in terms of changing the focus? One of his many suggestions was to deal more with treatment and reduce the mandatory minimum sentence for low-level drug offenses, expand eligibility for compassionate release, calling for question zero tolerance policies and other policies that lead to the school to prison pipeline. Those are some of what was announced.
Ian, I think that we will look back at this pronouncement as a watershed, as a turning point. I'm here to tell you as a judge, and most of my colleagues agree, that mandatory minimum sentences don't work. No one in the legislature, Congress, or anywhere else can determine an appropriate sentence without knowing who the perpetrator is, what the circumstances are, who the victims are, whether they were injured or not, the circumstances, etc. And it's just resulted in untold injustices. Everyone has lost except the prison guards unions and things like that. So it's about time. We need this. It's come many, many, too many decades late. But I think we'll look back and justifying the discussion, allowing some other political office holders to now stand up and be able to do the same thing in the states. So I'm very encouraged by it. It doesn't go nearly far enough, but I'm really encouraged by what happened today.
And as a former U.S. attorney, do you think that the idea of directing groups of U.S. attorneys to examine sentencing disparities and development recommendations to address them, and then for the U.S. attorney to designate a prevention and reentry coordinator, is that somebody that would, or is that a way to sort of to divert people into treatment as opposed to incarceration?
Well, yes. My problem is that it makes as much sense. You know who Robert Downey Jr. is, a very gifted actor, but he has had a lifelong heroin problem. It makes as much sense to me to put Robert Downey Jr. or people like that in jail for his heroin problem as it would have Betty Ford in jail for her alcohol problem, you know, the wife of President Gerald Ford, and she was a self-acknowledged alcoholic. It's the same thing. It's a medical issue. Those people should not be in the criminal justice system at all. But if Robert Downey Jr., Betty Ford, you or I drive a motor vehicle while impaired by any of these substances, including alcohol, which is my drug of choice, bring them to me as a judge. That's a crime. What's the difference? Because now, by their actions, they're putting our safety at risk. But otherwise, and again, being a libertarian and proud of it, and I'll stand on this anytime, it makes as much sense for the government, in my view, to hold me accountable for what I put into my body as it does what I put into my mind. It's none of their business. Hold me accountable for my actions instead. So I don't think the government should be diverting people into treatment unless by their actions, they've run afoul of the criminal justice system. If that's the case, then I did this as a judge right away for alcohol-related offenses, and because of people's actions, I was able to take about 60% of them off alcohol for at least 6 months, which is as long as I was able to keep statistics. That form of coercion, I think, is not only appropriate, but very beneficial for everybody.
Well, apparently of the 219,000 federal inmates behind bars, half of them are serving time for drug-related offences. And apparently in terms of recidivism, about 40% of former federal prisoners and more than 60% of former state prisoners are rearrested or have their supervision revoked within 3 years after their release, often for technical and minor violations of their probation.
That's true. You know, we have tens of thousands of people in state prison today that did nothing but smoke marijuana. Why? For the reasons you just said. For one reason or another, they were incarcerated, then placed on parole, and then smoked marijuana, and that's a violation of their probation or their parole, and back to jail or prison they go. That's stupid. That's senseless. But we just have to, by the way, don't get me wrong, if somebody is going to sell marijuana or heroin or whatever for money, that's a violation of law and they should be in prison, but probably not 10 years, maybe 5 or 2 years would be enough, or 30 and the rest. But if people violate the law intentionally to make money, I think that they should be held accountable and that should be a prison sentence. But if we were to regulate and control this, we don't have people selling bootleg alcohol anymore. By the way, we don't have Mexican drug cartels raising illegal vineyards in our national forests to compete with Robert Mondavi either. They could, but there's no money in it. So you take the money away by regulating and controlling it, taxing, no advertising, be less available for our children than it is today, just like Portugal found out, and Uruguay is beginning to find out.
Well, apparently one of the proposals that the Attorney General has offered is that the amounts that people are incarcerated for should not be an issue, as well as, of course, the disparity between crack cocaine and powdered cocaine, which is a fairly glaring anomaly. The argument is, of course, that the jails are not filled with drug kingpins, but minor users and dealers. Is that your experience?
That is true. The low-hanging fruit, you know, you have a lot of minorities that are selling drugs on the street corner. You know, they're selling dime bags of cocaine or something, $10 a hit, and they sell three. They end up with 10, 15 years in prison. So, I mean, it's really a lot easier. You can snatch up all of those that you want to. They're not kingpins. They are probably drug-addicted, selling drugs to support their habit. Those people should not be in prison. They should be in rehabilitation. But, I mean, and let's not carry this too far, obviously it's going to make a big difference if you're selling a ton of cocaine or just an ounce or just, you know, a couple of grams. So, and I'm sure that Attorney General Holder didn't mean it to that degree. But when I was a federal prosecutor, we had a RICO violation, a racketeering type thing. And if you were convicted of that, there were enhancements. It was a lot more serious. I chose, in many instances, not to use it because I didn't feel, as a prosecutor, in my discretion, that that was what Congress had in mind. Unfortunately, a lot of prosecutors have gone away from that. They do it because they can, not just because it's the right thing to do. And so I think that's what Attorney General Holder is addressing. But the better thing is to repeal mandatory minimum sentences in their entirety and just put up frameworks and allow probably a sentence commission of three judges to go on all to sentence on all three of the judges' calendars. We'll get a lot more uniformity that way instead of trying to do it artificially with mandatory minimum sentences.
And Judge Gray, let's look into the politics of it. You, of course, ran for Vice President of the United States on the Libertarian Party ticket with Gary Johnson in 2012. And a lot of our listeners are on the liberal side of the political spectrum, and you're a libertarian. So there seems to be some considerable common ground here between libertarians and liberals. And
we are classic liberals. We really would repeal this so-called Patriot Act. We're aghast that the government is collecting this information, not only on our telephone calls, emails, and I had that happen to me. I can go into it if you want. But also, they can do the same thing under that rationale with our credit card records and our travel records and things like that. It's simply wrong. and we have those classic liberal values. We would not have drones flying overhead surveilling us without a judicial warrant. Libertarians are classic liberals. We're also classic conservatives. So we believe in financial responsibility, but also social acceptance and the rule of our Constitution. So I feel very much akin to liberals.
Well, I was going to also suggest here that there's a conservative group form called Right on Crime, which is makes a conservative case for reforming the prison system. And it has Jeb Bush, former Florida governor and somebody that's often cited as a possible presidential candidate, and Edwin Meese, the former attorney general in the Reagan administration, and Newt Gingrich. So it seems across the board. My understanding is that there's been considerable prison reform even in Texas, which is often considered the harshest of all of the incarcerations in this country.
Texas has made really leaps and bounds progress, that they actually reduced the incarceration level, but I don't remember, 5 or 10%, and used money for treatment instead and for assistance in that regard. Crime went down. The prison population went down as well. So if they can do it in Texas, for heaven's sake, we should certainly follow that example all around the country.
So what's your sense then, since there's so much common ground here that can be nurtured. What's your sense of a political strategy moving forward to give the Attorney General some wind at his back and to not just to have this as which happens so often nowadays, you have great rhetoric but no follow through?
It's called leadership. You know, you should be making your reputation from the beginning. From every day that you're in office, you should be setting up your reputation. That's what Governor Gary Johnson did in New Mexico. You know, he stood up for liberties. He also left the state with a $1 billion surplus when he was done after his two terms in the governor's New Mexico. It just takes leadership. He stood up and said in 1999 that the war on drugs was a failure and has been acting on that ever since. He had no constituency. So it's just a question of finding leaders. Attorney General Holder has turned into a leader, at least on this area, somewhat late in his tenure, but I'll take it. It's just a question of leadership, and Ronald Reagan was a leader in that regard. He said, this is what I stand for, this is what I did, this is why. You can agree or disagree, but he stands up and says, this is who I am, this is what I'm doing, and these are the reasons, like it or not. And that's called leadership. We don't have any leadership, particularly in our country today. I was glad to see the Attorney General stand up and at least begin that process.
And what about followship? That's my real question.
No kidding. Well, you know, politicians are really good at followership. They'll follow where the votes are. And you mentioned my book, and thank you for that. When I endorse it, if people ask me to, I will say it's okay to discuss drug policy. Just that alone. If people allow themselves to discuss these issues, they will turn away from these failed policies. It's just a question, though, of looking soft on crime or something like that. So no one is going to accuse Attorney General Holder of being soft on crime. No one would accuse me of really being that either, being with my background, a Navy JAG attorney and federal prosecutor and judge. So it's just a question of giving people the authority, the ability to discuss these issues of three strikes, of mandatory minimum sentences, of drone attacks, of drone surveillance. All of these things, we need leadership, and we're suffering from a lack of it from my standpoint.
Well, James Gray, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, it's a pleasure. Look forward to doing it again, and thanks for what you do, Ian. You're really helping the cause.
Oh, well, thank you. Again, I've been speaking with James Gray, who's the author of Why Our Drug Laws Have Failed and What We Can Do About It. He is a California Superior Court judge, former federal prosecutor in the United States Attorney's Office in Los Angeles, and in 2012, he ran for vice president of the United States on the Libertarian Party ticket with Gary Johnson. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with the filmmaker of the Academy Award-nominated film about the failed war on drugs.
Revolving doors, what have I done? For someone on the TV, a tipping low. Revolving doors, what will I become?
Yeah.
I see my light come shining from the west down to the east. Any day now, any day now, I shall be released.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Eugene Jarecki, who is an author and dramatic and documentary filmmaker whose works include Why We Fight, The Trials of Henry Kissinger, Reagan, Freakonomics, and his latest film, The House I Live In, which was nominated for an Academy Award in 2012. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eugene Jarecki.
Hey, great to be here, Ian.
And today, for you, I imagine, since your very important film documented the failed war on drugs and the growing prison industrial complex that has given the United States the dubious shame of having 5% of the world's population but 25% of the world's prisoners, it looks as though Attorney General Eric Holder is trying to do something about it and to reverse this rather disgraceful trend.
Right. I think it's the most significant development in the prospective reform of the American war on drugs in its 40-year history. And I think Attorney General Holder is to be incredibly commended for, particularly in these politically divisive times, for, putting first principles first where they belong, for expressing justice and conscience rather than this very stale and obviously failed and embarrassingly failed system of sort of industrialized and institutionalized callousness, which has been standard operating procedure for 40 years. He's put a major step forward. You imagine that social change happens in small increments. This is a significant leap happened. And so we're tremendously gratified about it.
Well, some of his rhetoric was quite powerful, where he talked about the vicious cycle of poverty, criminality, incarceration that traps too many Americans and weakens too many communities. I mean, that's the message from your film.
It is, and we were extremely happy to hear it. It seems to me that you never know who gets to see your film. I know that the Attorney General's office asked to see the film several months ago. That was a very proud moment for us to send it. We've also been in a lot of touch with Obama's Office of Drug Control Policy under Gil Kerlikowske, the director of that office, and have been working closely with members of the administration and also people at the legislative level from Congress in the person of Bobby Scott, Congressman of Virginia, but also Pat Leahy of Vermont and others, to try to move on this at the legislative level. All of this is stuff we've worked hard for. We've also worked hard on the ground to get the movie out to people who matter in prisons and churches and schools across the country, forgotten people that never get to have their voices heard on this. And I think Holder did something incredible. Remember, there are Californians hunger striking right now in prisons, and that's been spreading across the country. They're at several weeks now standing for something, far larger than themselves, and you almost have the feeling that Holder has heard them. And it's a very rare moment when, truth gets spoken to power and power responds in a noble way. And God knows how this happened and what role everybody played, but it's a wonderful thing to be watching it happen and participating in it, even as a spectator and a contributor.
Well, the fact that the Attorney General's office asked to see the film is encouraging, and one can assume that if he didn't see it, he was certainly briefed about it. But tell us about how the film began, because it has some very, very powerful people backing it, does it not?
It does. We've had a lot of terrific support, particularly in Hollywood circles. Brad Pitt and John Legend and Danny Glover and Russell Simmons are executive producers of the film, and the film came out theatrically and also on television and on public television, and then it's now available kind of all over on iTunes and Netflix and where people can see it. The most important thing for me is that it's a conversation starter and promoter for people to understand the extraordinary gravity of what we've done with our drug laws over 40 years. We've spent $1 trillion. We've had 45 million drug arrests. We have achieved nothing with it other than a record of total and embarrassing failure. America is the leading incarcerating nation on earth. We have 2.3 million people behind bars, more than any other nation. And for all that, drugs are cheaper, purer, more available than ever before, and used by younger and younger people than ever before. It would be hard to add anything that would make it a greater failure. So
So it should come as no surprise that the highest law enforcement official in the land, who wants a safer and more efficient system of criminal justice, would want to change it. It's just that business as usual in Washington has not suggested that over decades. So Holder is doing what one would think a responsible public figure should do. It's just in this day and age, that is astonishing. And it takes nothing away from, therefore, from the courage of what he's done and the sort of and the backbone it requires to do that in today's Washington.
And again, I'm speaking with Eugene Jarecki, who is an author and dramatic and documentary filmmaker, whose latest film, The House I Live In, was nominated for an Academy Award in 2012. And Eugene, you're preceded on the program by Judge James Gray, who ran for president of the United States, or vice president, on the Libertarian Party ticket in 2012. And he indicates that there's a broad political support in terms of both libertarians and liberals. Do you think that's a winning coalition in terms of pushing this through? Because it's one thing for the Attorney General to make a speech. It's another thing to get these reforms enacted.
Sure. I think way too often there are polar extremes in this country that fail to see where they have common ground. So when you tell me that libertarians and liberals are finding themselves with common cause on this issue, more power to them, and more power to them for not letting what's different about them get in the way of what's the same. Look at Washington. Washington is hinging everything on its differences, and as a result, we have a completely, basically a shutdown government by any other name. And so it seems to me that if we could see some collaboration between liberals and libertarians on a subject, what is this? This is an unjust system that liberals don't like for that reason. It has deep racist overtones, which liberals don't like for that reason. And it is a record of embarrassment to our first principles, which liberals don't like, who want to stand by first principles that go long back in the American story. Libertarians are very concerned with bloated federal programs that that soak up American tax money and waste it into private interests, private pressure groups, and inappropriate profligacy. So there's nothing, there should be nothing surprising about them finding common cause. It's just all too often instead the groups, you know, get on other issues around which they have division rather than where they have union. This country can't tolerate that. It can't afford that anymore. It needs forward momentum in directions that will solve any number of the issues we face. And this is obviously, I would say, the most crucial one from a human rights perspective in the American story right now.
Well, I bring it up because the Congress, of course, are the reason for many of these draconian laws, particularly the Anti-Drug Abuse Act of 1986, which gives a minimum sentence of 5 years without parole, mandating that for possession of 5 grams of crack cocaine, while the same sentence was mandated for possession of 500 grams of powder cocaine. And that's one of the more egregious examples. So when you have a system that has expanded so extraordinarily, 800% in the last few years, you really have, clearly, you've got to get Congress on board, or you've got to change these laws.
For sure. And I think one of the ways we try to do that is by using the film to make it clear, as has happened several times in American history, that there is a system at work that no longer is acceptable in modern terms. Once upon a time, that was slavery, and it had to end. Then it was women's suffrage, which had to happen. Then it was the civil rights movement. Along the way, you know, we saw in South Africa that there was a moment where we went from apartheid as a condition that is persistent to an apartheid as a condition that is no longer acceptable. In the modern world, we do actually put to rest systems that violate basic premises of decency and sort of internationally recognized norms. The American drug war is a grotesque. If you described its conditions to an everyday person and you didn't say it was the United States, you'd think you were describing the criminal justice system of a third world dictatorship. So that is long overdue to be changed. And it just seems to me that, what we're seeing in Congress is the need to remind more Congress people that where it once might have seemed safe and politically clever to appear tough on crime, now that the Attorney General himself is using the language smart on crime, which many of us have been using for some time, especially Obama's mentor, Charles Ogletree, who's in my film, once he's using that, it's going to become awfully difficult for Congress people to keep hawking tough on crime rhetoric that does nothing but hurt the American people to benefit private interests and a sort of prison industrial complex that feeds on human life for its own gain. We just need to keep embarrassing that until it becomes no longer an acceptable mode of American business, and then we'll move to the business that should lie in the public health treatment of addiction, which is what we're really dealing with here. We wrongly treated addiction as a crime. It never was a crime. It never should have been categorized that way, and we are coming to see the light that there is a better way to do this. We are late. Other countries like Portugal have been at it for 10 years with great success. We are just waking up to that a little bit slowly.
Well, Eugene Turecki, is that also, though, a problem on the part of those that have advocated drug reform, in as much as they've allowed the status quo, the prison industrial complex, for the want of a better description, to frame reformers as those that would legalize drugs, when in fact the argument is not to legalize drugs, but to medicalize drugs?
Yeah, I think legalization is a dangerous term, partly because it's been so stigmatized by its enemies, that to use it now is to use the language of the enemy. I think that makes no sense. Most Americans hear legalization, and they correctly think, oh, that must mean, you know, cats and dogs living together and night of the living dead on every corner with people sort of hawking drugs to your child. But I think legalization is a problematic word for another reason, which is a government like our own has a responsibility to deal with a major public health issue, as which drugs are. And so to simply give the government a get-out-of-jail-free card, to say to the government, you've spent 40 years grotesquely profiting on this issue and not benefiting the people who needed protection and needed the involvement of a responsible government with a health care approach, instead of letting you now off the hook for that so that we just legalize and create a free-for-all, I'm not going to let you get off the hook. I'm going to say you now need to play the responsible role that you chose to play after Prohibition. When Prohibition blew up in our face, it's not that we then legalized alcohol and went nuts with it. What we did was said it's a controlled substance. Grown-ups can use it responsibly. Children cannot use it or be sold it. It's a crime to sell it to a child. And also, if you take alcohol and you combine it with an existing crime or accident in the public space, if you take your car out and hit somebody with it and kill them, that's going to be manslaughter. But if you were drinking, it's going to aggravate the charge. Well, that's a controlled substance, and that ought to be the way that we approach drugs in conjunction with other laws we have. No drug on the schedule of illegal drugs in this country is anywhere near as dangerous as alcohol, and yet we have far more stringent laws for drugs. How does that possibly make any sense? Well, it doesn't, and the Attorney General's step today is one more step, but a very meaningful one, toward making the conversation a rational one that moves us toward treatment and away from law enforcement.
Well, of course, the ironic legacy of Prohibition was that it resulted in organized crime, not to mention that Henry Ford was creating the world's biggest distillery of grain alcohol to fuel his cars. And here we are finally spending all this money on subsidizing gasohol or, you know, alcohol for cars when Prohibition killed it back when Henry Ford was trying to make it the norm here in America.
Yep. So we decided to repeat this idiocy, and the good news is Attorney General Holder is beginning to show some wisdom, really leading the way in terms of this in the American government. I think people need to support him tremendously, and they need to put pressure on their Congress people to support him tremendously and to see a moment where we can actually break free of the grip of tough on crime. Tough on crime is just one of the things that's like doping in the bicycle world. If one person does it, all of a sudden everybody has to do it. Well, somebody started being tough on crime once upon a time. It was Nixon. He wasn't really tough on crime, but he pretended to be. And once he pretended to be and won an election that way, everybody decided, oh, the only way to win elections in America is to scare people about the danger of their neighbor. Well, if we keep doing that, we're just going to bankrupt the country this way. So we should and must find a better approach. And I think this opens up the possibility for a smart on crime conversation. The greatest thing he did was to use those three words, smart on crime. Let's lay tough on crime and therefore the war on drugs to rest. Put it on the ash heap of history. Let's now be smart on crime and figure out what is a crime from what is simply an addiction, an affliction, something that needs medical care, not law enforcement.
And the Attorney General, in mentioning that the war on drugs cost $80 billion in 2010 alone. He also talked about, of course, the human and moral costs that are impossible to calculate. Do you think that, I mean, you have some of the conservative states already, Texas, for example, already seem to be getting the message and making changes and trying. And California, of course, has a prison overcrowding problem that the federal government is involved in and putting pressure on the governor in California who's been trying to appeal to the Supreme Court to get off the hook. So what's your sense in terms of whether this is like a double-barreled approach, both a moral argument and a practical argument?
Well, when you combine the moral and the economic, which is to say, if you that's really what I was mentioning earlier when I say that it's a joint venture between liberals and libertarians. The libertarians are not saying I'm opposed to the drug war by and large for moral reasons. They're saying this is a ridiculously failed, gigantically expensive federal program, $80 billion alone in 2010 with no results. How do we possibly argue for the continuation of that while cutting, but while showing austerity in other areas? Where's the austerity for the war on drugs? So that's their view. And then the liberal view is, how can we possibly in 2013, with an African-American president and a legacy of struggle to get to an enlightened place, how can we possibly be repeating not only the stupidity of prohibition, the disaster of that, but so much of the horrors of Jim Crow, Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, which talks about the drug war in exactly those terms? How can we be so regressive? So there is a moral calling to make ourselves live up to the founding principles we all espouse. And yet there's also a practical economic calling to say this country can't afford this kind of insanity. So, yes, he is right to play on both sides of that because both matter, and this is a great opportunity for both to be met with one solution. You kill two very important birds with one stone.
And, of course, the Attorney General did mention the disparity in sentencing where blacks are sentenced 20% longer than whites.
Yeah, and that's a newly improved statistic. It's been far worse over time, so he's great to mention it. There are even more harrowing statistics, but I think he probably is cautious about coming across as too much of a heavy breather, so he gives the one that sounds most reasonably controllable. And there are far worse statistics than that 20% one. That sounds rather manageable to most people. The reality is, for example, that with crack cocaine, we've always thought crack was a black drug. Well, it turns out the majority of crack users in America are and always have been white. I never knew that. I only learned it while making my film. And what I also learned is that black people only represent 15% of the country, and they are 15% of the crack users. So not only does that make the majority of crack users white in America, but you then have to deal with the harrowing reality that in our federal courts, 90% of those charged with crack offenses are black. So 15% of people using crack are black, yet 90% of those charged are black. Now, that's a statistic I want people to hear.
Well, you can also add to the fact that the majority of people using food stamps are white and the majority of people that are poor in this country are white. So there's a lot of reasons why we should revisit most of those sort of prejudicial statistics that we have. But do you think that given that your film covers the journey of so many people in, from the inner cities into these overcrowded prisons, and you have testimony from drug users, from judges, from narcotics officers, from prison guards, and they're all acknowledging this broken system. One of the things that I hadn't heard about before that the Attorney General brought up was the school-to-prison pipeline, where he said that those zero-tolerance school discipline policies instead serve as a gateway to the criminal justice system. A minor school disciplinary offense could put a student in the principal's office, should put a student in the principal's office, not in a police precinct. What's he talking about there? I mean, this is one aspect of it that I wasn't aware of.
Well, sure. I mean, it even goes further. It can even be understood as a cradle-to-prison pipeline. I mean, you know, we have companies like the Corrections Corporation of America that talk to its shareholders in ways that would blow your mind. It's harrowing on a level that I.G. Farben didn't aspire to. They talk about how they make predictions about their future earnings as a prison corporation based on the childhood performances of people in inner cities, based on the test scores of young people. They can tell you who will fill those beds. In other words, they are banking on the demise of American urban and rural communities for their betterment. And so that kind of a pipeline is not just school to prison, it's cradle to prison. It is a construct that assumes a system that runs on human beings for its livelihood, and it counts on the despair of those human beings as a source of business profit, as a source of, you know, economic profit. It can't get more harrowing. It's just time. It's got to end. This is like talking about it's a gulag reality underlying whatever veneer the American public lives with. And the Attorney General has done a great service in bringing a big chunk of this to light, but of course the battle's just beginning and the implementation will be terribly important. And I give him all the support I possibly can, and I want, you know, anyone listening and anyone aware of this issue to speak to their congresspeople about how important implementation is, that they have the courage to be smart on crime. Because you no longer have to be as courageous as you used to be. It is too expensive to be tough on crime. It is un-American to be tough on crime. It's un-Christian. It's uneducated. It's anti-scientific. It's completely failed. And so you don't have to be a genius to say, well, maybe there's a better way to do this. It used to be that you could fear-monger people into being tough on crime. I don't think that works anymore. So I think he's just led the way to say, hey, guys, the water's warm in here. Why don't you come in, you know, into this area where it's a bit more humane and a bit less wasteful?
Well, just in closing, Eugene Turecki, given that the Attorney General has opened the door here, it would seem to me this is a good moment for people across the country to get your film that lays out this whole story of how we got to this position and the full scope of this enormous human and economic tragedy that is, as I mentioned in the opening, is America's shame. Are there ways for communities to get hold of your films? In other words, to create a political movement, to put some wind at the back of the Attorney General?
Absolutely. They can go to our website, which is thehouseilivein.org. They can also follow us at Drug War Movie on Facebook and on Twitter. And I think what they can do there is they can see the film in a lot of different ways. It's on Netflix. It's on iTunes. I frankly don't care if people pirate the movie. People should see it however they want to. If they go on the website and they want to communicate with us, we can help them set up screenings in communities around the country. There's a Get Involved clickable button on our website where you can write to us and you can fill out a form that arranges a screening in your area, and we can also do that in conjunction with your policymakers in a local way. We get very hands-on involved with anybody who wants to show the film, and whether it's in a church, a prison, a school, a community center, a state house, all of that is welcome. We do it every day, and we really welcome contact from people who get to see the film or who want to see the film. But please do follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Those are good ways of being aware of what is happening, both with the drug war on its own and also with our efforts to contribute to it.
And again, the website is?
Website is just the title of the movie, thehouseilivein.org.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Eugene Turecki.
Thank you, Ian. It's nice to talk about something positive happening in the world.
Indeed, and I'm grateful. Again, I've been speaking with Eugene Turecki, who is an author and dramatic documentary filmmaker whose works include Why We Fight, The Trials of Henry Kissinger, Reagan, Freakonomics, and his latest film, The House I Live In, which was nominated for an Academy Award in 2012. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how the threats we face compared to our bloated military budget look puny and paltry.
In a little tent, oh, and just like the river I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come.
Sore, I'll be safe and you'll be sorry when the wolf comes to your door.
Who's afraid of the big bad wolf? Big bad wolf, big bad wolf. Who's afraid of the big bad wolf?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Cohen, a fellow at the Century Foundation and a columnist at Foreign Policy, where he writes a regular feature on politics and national security. He's the author of Live from the Campaign Trail, The Greatest Presidential Campaign Speeches of the 20th Century and How They Shaped Modern America. And previously, Michael served in the United States Department of State as chief speechwriter for the U.S. representative to the United Nations. He has an article in the UK Guardian, Threat to America, the size of its own military budget. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Cohen.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be here. And I should just mention before we go on, just so my editor doesn't get upset with me, that I write a column for The Guardian now and no longer for Foreign Policy.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No worries at all.
All right. Well, I'll update our bio for you. And of course, The Guardian has been extremely on top of things lately, breaking all of this Snowden stuff. I'm curious, you know, why it is that The Guardian, which operates, it's a trust, a nonprofit, which I think is a very interesting media model to talk about in another conversation. But the fact that they're breaking all of this important stories, and the British press is subject to D-notices where the government can step in prior to publication and stop publication on the grounds of national security. How come The Guardian has not been stopped? And why has The Post not published the same stuff that they were given?
I think the Guardian was given more information than the Post. I think it was a big part of the reason why. And as far as I have been stopped in the U.S., I mean, you know, we've adjudicated that issue, luckily, with the Pentagon Papers debate, and thankfully the government can't shut them down from publishing this. So, you know, it's one of the positive features of our constitutional system here in the U.S. We have such a broad freedom of the press.
No, I get that. I was wondering why the British side.
Oh, that I couldn't tell you. I can only speak to the U.S. Sure. U.S. law on that issue.
Well, let's talk about what's been happening lately in the press and your article in the UK Guardian the threat to America, the size of its own military budget, where you talk about how the number two guy at the CIA, Michael Morell, had this recent article in an interview in the Wall Street Journal just on the eve of his retirement, where he listed all of the threats that we're facing, and you were underwhelmed.
Yes, I would say I was largely underwhelmed by it. You know, the biggest threat that Morell mentioned was Syria, the Syrian civil war. And the rationale for it was pretty unique, I would say. The concern is the Syria will be, eventually the Assad government will fall, it will be taken over by the rebels, the rebels will be of a jihadist nature, Syria will become a safe haven, which it already has sort of become, to some extent, for al-Qaeda groups. And this will then pose some sort of threat to the U.S. or maybe to U.S. interests in the region. That is kind of the sort of 1% doctrine on steroids, you might say. You know, certainly what's happening in Syria is horrible, horrible for the Syrian people above all. But I think the threat to the U.S. from that civil war is fairly minor. And if that's the greatest threat facing the U.S., it sort of makes you wonder what we're scared about, because that is not a serious anywhere near-term threat to the U.S. And certainly it's worth mentioning, too, that even those who talk about Syria as being sort of a haven for al-Qaeda don't talk about these al-Qaeda groups being hostile to the U.S. If anything, they're more hostile toward Russia, which is, of course, supporting the Assad regime in Damascus. So the idea that this is the number one threat, I mean, really does kind of, I think, sort of unintentionally or sort of inadvertently by Morell, exposes exactly how little we face in serious security threats around the world.
Well, of course, the Bush administration did not take Colin Powell's rather tepid advice, which is, you know, before the invasion of Iraq, you know, the pottery barn analogy: if you break it, you own it. We've broken Iraq, but we've walked away, and Iran owns it. And one of the lies that led to the Iraq war was that the al-Qaeda is playing footsie with Saddam, and they're in Iraq. Well, that was never true. But ironically, it's become true now. And then you have al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and we've had all of this crying wolf going on lately, that we're about to have a big terrorist attack and embassies have been shut. And, you know, you just wonder how long we can keep this up. Our entire, this powerful $600 billion annual budget for the military is being directed at a handful of losers living in a cave somewhere.
About part of it also. I mean, if you think about post 9/11, you know, al-Qaeda had a safe haven. It was in Pakistan. And until really the Obama administration ramped up the drone war, it was a safe haven that was rather basically unmolested, in which, you know, terrorists could come and do as they wanted to, and they didn't have to. I mean, there was obviously some pressure from the U.S., but not a great deal. And yet in that period, there was not a single major terrorist attack on U.S. soil. In fact, there's not been a single major terrorist attack on U.S. soil in the 12 years since 9/11. So it's interesting even that Morell actually mentioned that Syria could become like Pakistan. And, you know, it's a striking thing that we sort of, you hear the word terrorist, you hear the word safe haven, everyone sort of cowers in fear. You know, Obama used that exact language to justify the surge in Afghanistan in 2009, the argument being that if we weren't there, Afghanistan would be taken over by the Taliban and again become a safe haven. But I think, you know, the reality is that even if those terrible worst-case scenarios were to occur, it doesn't really mean that the U.S. faces a terrible threat that they can't deal with in some other way. I think that the problem is that we sort of tend to assume absolute worst-case scenarios, and you know, what Dick Cheney called the 1% doctrine, that, you know, if something's a 1% chance of happening, it's going to happen, and that's how we should respond. That's not really the way to respond to any other public health issue in the U.S. It's sort of remarkable that we responded to terrorism in such a broad and sort of over-cautious manner, to a degree to which, and as you mentioned, we even invaded Iraq because of the outside possibility that Saddam would restart his nuclear weapons program, give a weapon to al-Qaeda, and al-Qaeda would blow up in the U.S. That was the justification for war. And it seems even flimsier now, 10 years later, than it was at the time. But that's the kind of threat-mongering that I think has become so pervasive in American politics that we sort of just ignore it. And the Morrell piece to me was so striking because it was such an... If you just took a second to think about what he was saying, it was sort of obvious that we're not really in danger, and that the threats that we're talking about are pretty minor.
I wish there was somebody around that was the opposite of Chicken Little, that the sky is falling. You know, we had this so much in our politics. Go back to JFK. Kennedy got elected on the basis of the missile gap that was phony. And Eisenhower knew, but he couldn't say anything about it because he didn't want to expose the secrets that the U.S. had over what the Russians really had. Reagan got elected on the basis that Carter and the Democrats had let our defenses down, and Carter had canceled the B-1. So we've had paranoia and driving our politics and certainly fueling and funding our military budgets. But after 9/11, I just wish that somebody would have pointed out the obvious ridiculous nature of what people like the chairman of the Joint Chiefs at the time and Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, and the Bush administration, they all said that al-Qaeda and the terrorist threat are the greatest threat we've faced. And for God's sake, we survived, 30 years with the possibility, a real possibility, that within 20 minutes, every major city in the United States could be vaporized. And millions would die. And, you know, we lost 3,000 people on 9/11. That's not to downplay that. But if just one Russian missile had gotten through in the Cold War, that would have been 10,000 9/11s. The proportionality of all this has been lost.
Yeah, this is one of the remarkable things, about this, the threat mongering that goes on. You know, as you mentioned, and you mentioned Kennedy, the missile gap, and certainly you could talk about Vietnam as well. You know, threat inflation is not new, and fear mongering is not new, and this goes back to really the dawn of the Cold War. You know, so politicians have long sort of played up foreign threats. You know, the Soviet threat was always overstated, but of course, you know, it was a real threat. I mean, as you say, the chance of nuclear war, while very slim, certainly existed. So it's not. It was something that, you know, we should certainly be concerned about and focused on. What is striking is if you look at the post-Cold War period, the nature of threats to the U.S. have not only declined dramatically, but the international environment has changed dramatically. So first of all, you have this long-term trend of a decline in conflict, decline in war, interstate war. You know, wars between countries has basically disappeared. It rarely, if ever, happens anymore. The last major one really was the Iraq War, the Gulf War, the first Gulf War. And, of course, actually, I should say, the second Iraq War was another one as well, but, of course, started by the U.S. But in general, countries do not invade other countries. Territorial conquest is no longer a key consideration of politicians or of states in general. And so you also have this broad international system, the United Nations and other regional organizations, that are dedicated to preserving peace and to preventing conflict from breaking out. So we're living in a period of incredible safety, of extraordinary decline in war, and yet you still have this kind of pervasive mindset that, you know, just around the corner is the next war, the next conflict, the next threat. And for the U.S., it's even more crazy. You think about it, the U.S. faces no competitor, no military competitor, no hegemonic competitor, nobody who is even interested in sort of, you know, no state that wants to mess with us. And yet, that doesn't seem to penetrate the thinking of policymakers. There's lots of reasons why that happens. It's a lot of bureaucratic reasons, political reasons. But it is a striking feature of our politics that as we become safer, we seemingly become more scared of potential threats. And the post-9/11 is, as you said, the perfect example of that phenomenon.
Well, I've spoken to some Russian military analysts, and they're completely morose when they look at the comparison between the Russian military and the United States military, and they point out, you know, the U.S. military has had all this war experience. Obviously, it's been catastrophic for the U.S. In terms of its standing in the world, and they've lost all of the wars since World War II, arguably. But they do have an enormous experience, and apparently the use of the of technology in the information age of computers and communications is decades ahead of any other possible adversary. Perhaps even a century ahead. You know, they are so far ahead in terms of integrating information into warfare that nobody's even on the same field. But, you know, what explains then that we can't sort of relax and think, okay, you know, we're the superpower, let's just, you know, be cool and not be so paranoid?
Well, I think that's a great question. I think there's a number of factors at play. There's a political factor. That's really, I think, what drives so much of this threat inflation, is that you first of all have Republicans who always want to play up these types of threats because it plays their political advantage on national security. And certainly you saw this post 9/11, in which I would argue that one of the main reason that George Bush was reelected in 2004 was amazingly because of the Iraq War, because he was seen as somebody who could better protect the U.S. from overseas threats. So I think the political imperative is a strong one. I think for Democrats, of course, you know, they're so afraid of being branded as being weak or soft or feckless that they tend to overcompensate on national security. You've seen this with Obama and the surge in Afghanistan and the drone war affair, and even some of the surveillance, you could argue, as well. So certainly that's a big part of it. But it's also a bureaucratic interest here as well. And that's a big part of it. If you go back to February, before the sequestration took place, which cut the military budget, you had uniformed officers of the military going before Congress and saying that if these cuts go through, you know, we can't guarantee that we can protect the U.S. against foreign threats. You know, you had Martin Dempsey, who's the head of chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, saying that this is the most dangerous period in his lifetime. This is a guy who was born in the 50s. You know, you had people warning that this would, if we weakened our military budget even a little bit, it would invite aggression. I mean, this is absurd, it's sort of fear mongering, but there's a bureaucratic imperative here, which is the military, and you know, the whole sort of national security infrastructure, think tanks and contractors and what have you, they want people to believe the world is unsafe and the world is dangerous because it justifies these vast military budgets. And I was fascinated by the Morrell article. One thing that sort of didn't get much notice is that he said for his next job, he probably would go work for a security company.
They're the old revolving door.
Exactly.
Well, Michael, we've run out of time. And by the way, I might add that all the money that was taken out of the Defense Department's sequestration was put back in to pork barrel the immigration bill to build up the border against the great threat from Mexico. So you know, the beat goes on. I thank you for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure, as always.
Again, I was speaking then with Michael Cohen, a fellow at the Century Foundation, a columnist at The Guardian, where he writes a regular feature on politics and national security. He's the author of Life and the Campaign Trail, the greatest presidential campaign speeches of the 20th century and how they shaped modern America. And he previously served in the United States Department of State as the chief speechwriter for the U.S. representative to the United Nations. He has an article in the UK Guardian, Threat to America, the Size of Its Own Military Budget. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back in tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. An angel song about the home of the brave and the land.